Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim White and I'm joined by my dad, John White. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim. It's good to be here.
And we're really pleased to have a guest with us this week. That's Chris Goswami. How are you, Chris?
I'm great, and it's great to be here, Tim. Thanks.
For those who haven't come across you and your writing on the internet on many topics in the past, do you want kind of briefly explaining who you are and what you do and what leads you to our door today?
Yeah, sure. So I've worked in the tech industry for over 30 years, software development, telecommunications companies, Silicon Valley companies, and just kind of retired from that job earlier last year. In parallel, I'm a Baptist minister at a local church here in Cheshire. And then the third thing I do is I do write on my website, which is called 7minutes.net, the number 7minutes.net, on matters of that I come across that cross life and faith, and in particular technology and faith, as that is my background.
Well, we're really pleased to have you on the show, in particular because we're tackling a quite complicated topic today, which is cryptocurrency, something that I think is almost daily in the news, and yet something a lot of Christians, I think, are probably still struggling to wrap their heads around. Before we go any further, we want to state very upfront that this episode and the next week's episode, we're going to be carrying on talking to Chris. We're going to talk a lot about cryptocurrency, about finance, about investment. None of this counts as investment advice. None of the three of us are trained financial advisors, and so please do not use anything we say to do or not do anything. If you're wondering about what to do with your own money, please go and speak to a properly financially regulated and trained professional. This is just three kind of lay Christians interested in tech trying to bat around some of these important ideas. I guess the first thing before we kind of dig into the meat of this is to try and explain for those who are really baffled what exactly a cryptocurrency is. Chris, do you want to have a stab at that, and we'll see where we get to?
Yeah, and it's not an easy concept to get your head around. And some of the coins that are called cryptocurrency aren't currencies, but some of them are. So let's step back, and if you cast your mind back to 2008. And the year that institutions that couldn't fail suddenly failed, and institutions that couldn't possibly go bankrupt went bankrupt, and they were the banks. They failed not just in the UK, but around the world, and we now call that the financial crash of 2008. Now, in the aftermath of that 2008 crash, a lot of things changed. Some regulation around banks changed, but a group of people or persons, we can come back to who that is, came up with a vision. They produced a white paper for a new vision for a new currency called Bitcoin. And they proposed that this new currency shouldn't depend on banks that can fail disastrously. In fact, it shouldn't depend on banks at all. It'd be a new form of tender, independent of any of the then financial organizations. So that was the vision. But the question then is, what exactly is Bitcoin, and where does it come from? So I'm going to use a comparison here of digging for gold, which I think is something that if we haven't done, I haven't done it, but we all understand that. So if you think about it, mining for gold, if you want to look for gold, you can go out legally, you can buy a spade, go up to Scotland where there are traces of gold and start digging. And if you're really lucky, you might find gold. We call it mining. Obviously, on a more industrial scale, most of the time, that's how gold is mined. Well, bitcoins also are mined. They are mined, but not by digging holes in the ground. They are mined by computers solving puzzles. So the people who set up Bitcoin devised this complex puzzle algorithm to which even they don't know the solutions, but there are a number of solutions. And now what we find is there are thousands of computers around the world which are trying to find solutions to this Bitcoin problem. Every time they find a solution, everybody else in the Bitcoin network, in the Bitcoin chain, agrees that the person who found the solution, the next solution, owns a Bitcoin. So if you find a solution, Tim or John, you own a Bitcoin, and we all agree that you own a Bitcoin. So that's one similarity to gold. Another similarity to gold is that if you think about it, gold doesn't actually have any value intrinsically in itself. It's just a metal. It's shiny and it's yellow and we like the look of it. It has value because around the world we've all agreed that gold, an ounce of gold, is worth so much in dollars or pounds. So similarly, enough people have agreed around the world that when you find a solution to this puzzle and you get a Bitcoin, that has a certain value. So then it becomes usable as a currency for which you can use to buy and sell on the internet. Now, the kind of third bit of this, if you like, and then I'll stop, is the whole network of computers around the world that are searching for Bitcoins, and there are thousands of them. They monitor every transaction, every Bitcoin transaction that occurs on the internet. So let's say I bought a pair of trainers on Amazon, and you can indirectly use Bitcoin on Amazon. Let's say I bought a pair of trainers. All the thousands of computers around the world that are managing Bitcoin agree that Chris Goswami now owns one less Bitcoin. Let's say it's an expensive pair of trainers. One less Bitcoin, and Amazon has one more Bitcoin. And we call that network of computers that monitor and manage Bitcoin transactions around the world the blockchain. It's a technical term, but that it just means this online ledger. So that's the idea. It's you know, you could then ask the question, well, can I use my computer, or can you use your computer to mine Bitcoin? And the answer is yes, you can download free software to mine Bitcoin. But realistically, you need a warehouse full of computers to realistically have a chance to solving this puzzle, in much the same way that you could buy a spade and go off, you know, down the road and say, I'm going to dig for gold. You can definitely do that and you might find some, but you probably won't. You need industrial equipment and intelligence. So that's, I hope that helps just set the playing field there. Mm.
Yeah, that's really helpful. Thanks so much, Chris. I guess what is interesting and what is new, I mean, we've had digital money, as it were, you know, traditional currencies, pounds and dollars, have, you know, people are very familiar that you can buy and sell and send money over the internet. And in fact, the vast majority of transactions in old currencies now happen that way. You know, cash is a vanishingly small proportion of that. So I guess what we need to be clear is that what differentiates Bitcoin as a digital currency is not that it's all on the internet and doesn't actually have any physical form, but that it's not, there's no central bank underpinning it. You know, so the key thing for the dollar is that there's the US Federal Reserve, which holds stores of gold and other things in its vaults and regulates and manages the flow of the currency. And a key thing that Satoshi Nakamoto, the person or persons who invented Bitcoin, wanted to avoid was that there should be no one single central bank that could control this currency. It's often called decentralized finance, or DeFi, because it's kind of belongs to everyone. And that's the key critical, I guess, breakthrough of the blockchain, is that it allows kind of, you can trust that Amazon does have one more Bitcoin and Chris has one less, because the blockchain is a public ledger, but it is irreversible. Once a transaction's been added to the blockchain, it can never be taken away and can't be tampered with.
So you've absolutely hit a key point there, which is that when we do normal transactions, either in real life or on the internet, as you pointed out, Tim, financial institutions are involved. So I might use my Visa card or MasterCard or American Express. They're involved. Then it gets settled by a bank, HSBC or Barclays. They're involved at that point. And as you pointed out, a key difference here is there are no financial institutions involved. It's kind of crowdsourced, if you like many things on the internet, that we just agree. So the three of us just agree between us, as we could, that Chris now owns one less Bitcoin and somebody else owns one more Bitcoin. But there's no bank, there's no credit card company, there's nothing like that. Correct.
And so thanks very much, Chris, because it's a very helpful overview. I think another fascinating aspect of all this is that therefore effectively it seems there's no regulation. You know, so if I'm trying to open an account in a bank these days, it's like getting into Fort Knox, isn't it? They want to know absolutely everything about you. They need your passport, they need your proof of identity. There's clearly a whole lot of security measures looking out for money laundering and money coming from dodgy sources and all the rest. But the whole point about Bitcoin and these other cryptocurrencies is that they appear to be completely unregulated at present, and nobody really knows. It's crowdfunding, it's crowdsourced, and so they've got this very dodgy reputation, haven't they? So for instance, I understand that a lot of the ransomware that's going around, where some big company gets trapped by software and they're asked to pay a ransom in Bitcoin in order to release their, so the criminals are using Bitcoin, presumably as a way of evading regulation. So how does that work? If it's an open ledger, how can a criminal be using it?
Well, let's talk about, let's address that in a couple of steps. First of all, is it a good thing or a bad thing to remove banks and traditional financial institutions from the system? So yes and no. Removing banks from the system achieves the vision that Satoshi Nakamoto, person or persons who invented this, had, which is to reduce the dependence on institutions that can fail and that also cost money. So every time the bank manages a transaction for you or for me, somebody has to get paid, an office has to get heated, etc., etc. That costs money, it takes time. On the other hand, as you've kind of intimated, banks have a pretty clear idea of who's spending money, and they have a reputation of blocking financial activity, which appears illegitimate. So I think, we would all say that your banks are not perfect, but at this point they are well regulated. I think this idea that it's a source of criminal activity. So the online ledger, this network of users of Bitcoin, is actually very hard to hack, first of all. In fact, it's almost impossible to hack. If you want to hack the system, the Bitcoin system, you have to attack thousands, possibly millions of computers worldwide simultaneously. That makes it very secure and very traceable, that we know, we can trace when a Bitcoin transaction happens, and we can trace when it gets converted into actual currency. Now, in terms of criminal activity, that is an accusation that's come up against Bitcoin a number of times. A number of things that you could say about that is, is that any different, really? So if you think about cash, for example, there are institutions, big and small. So there's a fast food place in my town that only takes cash. Why is that? I don't know. It might be legitimate, or there may be a tax incentive for them, an illegal tax incentive. And so there is actually a lot of unethical trading going on anyway. Now, there's very little actual hard evidence that more unethical activity is happening with crypto than with other forms of payment.
So just again to clarify, from my own understanding, when a criminal is using Bitcoin, everybody would know like the IP address of the computer or whatever, but they wouldn't necessarily know precisely who was operating it. Or is it possible to use software techniques to hide your identity?
There have been, yes, you can use software techniques to hide your identity. It's difficult, but you can do that. But there have been some high profile prosecutions of criminals who have tried to use Bitcoin to mask their activity. You know, you could look those up. And again, I would say, I don't, you know, there's not much evidence that there's more, proportionally more illegal activity with Bitcoin than other forms of payment. It's new, and that is a problem for people that we don't understand it. That can lead us into places where we do end up losing money.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
The kind of the thing that triggered us deciding to tackle this as a topic on Matters of Life and Death really was what's being called crypto winter. So that's this kind of probably about nine, maybe even a year, where the value of Bitcoin, most prominently, but a whole host, if not all, cryptocurrencies has been plummeting after a kind of peak during the kind of earlier years of the COVID era, and with it, lots of kind of high profile crypto institutions, most recently FTX, which is a kind of exchange where you could buy and sell different cryptocurrencies and convert them from different into traditional currencies, completely fell apart, and its kind of leadership has now been arrested and charged with various kind of fraudulent activity, and several others. Do you think, well, I guess one, what is going on here? Why is the kind of sector taking a battering at the moment? And two, this is kind of creating a lot of nervousness or anxiety among people who might have invested in or kind of considering that. Is that good anxiety, or should we say actually this let's take a step back and calm down, it's not the end of crypto as we know it?
I think the first thing I'd say, Tim, is that if we'd done this interview, let's say this time last year, I think the tone of the conversation would have been different, because all cryptocurrencies were on the rise, they were soaring, and maybe we would more have been saying, hey, you know, this seems really good, how good can it get? But in fact, you're right. In the last 6 months, certainly in the last year, most cryptocurrencies, possibly all of them, have plummeted, even crashed in value. In fact, it's estimated that something like $2 trillion has vanished from cryptocurrencies since November 2021. Again, you know, let's compare this to like things that are to like. Let's compare like to like, okay? And I want to use the example of internet technology and internet businesses. If you think back, and I think all of us are old enough to remember the internet being quite new in the early 90s, there was a period of growth, and then there was a period of hypergrowth, of inflated growth, of hype. And around 2001, we had what we call the dot-com bubble, where actually hundreds of companies that were overvalued, overinflated in value, either went bust or lost share value. So the company that I worked for, which was a company called Open Wave Systems, Silicon Valley-based company, in 2001, its share value was, or before the crash, was something like $400. I don't remember immediately what it went down to, but just a couple of years later, the share value was less than a dollar, right? Wow. So hundreds of times. Yeah, that's when I got them. my share options came at a dollar each. That was great. But
Back to the drawing board.
Yeah, but here's the thing. And some people became very rich and some people lost lots of money. Yeah. There were stories in Silicon Valley of gorgeous ladies going out with very geeky software engineers, marrying them.
So that wasn't you, Chris, rich. Then, was
that
it?
That wasn't me, actually. Oh, no, I wish it was. No, no, no. Marrying them and divorcing them and taking half their money. So it was an absolute inflation and then a plummeting. And that kind of bandwagon, that isn't that unusual with disruptive technologies on the internet. It's not that unusual. You know, so another example. I used to work on a school governor's board with some other chaps, and I remember one of the guys coming in one day. He worked for AstraZeneca, very creditable, well-known pharmaceutical company. And we had a chat. He says, "Oh, it's terrible! It's terrible! The share price of AstraZeneca has crashed. It's crashed." And I said, what? You mean, what? It's gone down, what, 10% or something? He said, yeah, 10%, almost 10%. And I said, my company does that every week. It's up 10, it's up 12, it's down 9. That is internet technology. It's just where most of us are not in that area. And even in crypto, there have been other crashes, not as big as this one, but other crashes due to over-speculation. But the cycle repeats, and some would say, we are not, obviously, we on this podcast are not offering investment advice, but some people would say that this is the right time to invest. And I think it's interesting that like Bitcoin has halved in value from something like $36,000 per Bitcoin to 15 or 16 now. But it's still there at a quite high value. There are still millions of people using it, and it's a resistant network. It's still continuing. It still has millions of followers. I think it comes down to what we're used to and what we're not used to.
But speculation, of course, has been around for centuries, hasn't it? I mean, I'm remembering about the Dutch tulip boom, wasn't there? I mean, so this idea of massive speculative gambles, really, followed by disastrous crashes and people losing all their money and so on, it's not new, but it does seem... there's something about the whole internet fintech world, isn't there, which encourages... it's so easy to click, you know, online gambling, isn't it? And I just remember the stocks and shares, the what was that video company where a whole bunch of day traders...
GameStop, yeah.
That's right.
Pumped up the
they
stock.
They pumped it up, made a massive profit, so then it went...
Then it crashed.
Crashed. So, in a sense, I mean... At that end of the market, it's very much like a casino, isn't it? It's a form of gambling.
Well, I think there certainly are some people who view it as gambling, and it can be gambling. And I think, you know, on the next edition of this podcast, we're going to talk about ethical arguments from the Bible, and there is this thing, this FOMO, fear of missing out, as well. However, I guess what I'd say about that is, some people say isn't it a Ponzi scheme where it's just, you're just actually waiting for the value of this thing to rise and pulling in more people to invest in it so that the Bitcoins that you've got will go up in value, okay? But that actually isn't that different to investing in many other assets or commodities. You know, if you invest in gold, you're just sitting there with an ounce of gold, or you know, ownership of an ounce of gold, waiting for the price to go up. So if you're, if people are doing this as part of a portfolio, or they're doing it because they are happy with the ethics, and we'll come to the ethics soon, and it's part of their investment portfolio, then I think I would not agree. It's like gambling. It's only as like gambling as investing in many other commodities or even some companies, you know.
Isn't the difference between traditional investment that, and again, not an investment advice, not a financially trained person, but if you invest in, you know, even some of those dot-com companies that were absurdly overvalued, and there was a necessary though painful correction, they did provide services, you know. Pets.com is a classic example. It did actually sell pet food. It probably wasn't worth what people thought it was, but it sold a service that had value. And similarly, if you invest, if you're buying and selling oil or some other commodity, oil is not a mythical substance. It exists, and you can take a barrel of oil, you could just hold on to it and wait for the price to go up and sell it, but you could also use it to power your car or to run a generator. And I guess the argument often goes that, unlike this, cryptocurrencies are completely intangible and they have no functional utility except to fluctuate in value, and so you hope to buy low and sell high, particularly because they're so volatile that they struggle to actually act as a currency. Because imagine the pound in your pocket was worth one day, it was worth 72 cents, let's say, in the US currency, and the next day it was worth 70,000 cents, and then the next day it was down to 70 cents again. You can't actually use that as a unit of exchange because it's far too volatile. Traditional currencies, they change in value, but by fractions of a percent. So realistically, the argument goes, I'd love to hear your response to this, cryptocurrencies are actually just speculative investments, but unlike traditional investments, it's thin air, and so it is purely kind of tulip mania, but you can't even, at least you could plant a tulip bulb in the ground and have a beautiful flower.
Yeah, no, so I think this is a strong argument against cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin, but it's not as one-sided as you've just said. So it is true, I think I would agree, that if you invest in stocks and shares or as part of a balanced pension portfolio, as I have, and perhaps I'm sure you have as well, and so my pension portfolio is in what's called ESG funds, environmental and socially well-governed funds. And so, you know, I do that because my investments, hopefully, are used to provide jobs, you know, for companies to grow, to provide education, provide work. And I'm investing in that. And I think that is a strong argument. However, proponents of Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies would say, well, it's not as intangible as you suggest. If you invest in Bitcoin now, the network is so big. You are investing in a network, and you are investing in technology, which we'll come to later, this blockchain thing, which is used in other industries and to support other industries. You're investing in actually in a world of in a new industry, in an upcoming industry. And it is true, actually, that you know, your big City of London financial organizations, they are now employing bright young people to pursue solutions based on cryptocurrencies. Wall Street, City of London, they are employing people now to pursue solutions based on cryptocurrencies. So not to the same degree, but it's not true that it's you're just investing in something waiting for it to go up.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. Can I just raise another sort of ethical issue, which is about the amount of energy that is used to generate these, you know, to perform these mathematical puzzles. As you say, there are thousands, if not millions, of computers as we speak, whirring away, chewing up energy, doing nothing more useful than trying to solve a mathematical puzzle. And apparently, you know, the people, these so-called Bitcoin miners who are most successful have warehouses full of these things. And people have calculated, haven't they, the amount of energy that's being consumed, the amount of carbon dioxide that's being created, and it's equivalent to a sort of small to medium-sized country, apparently. So isn't that a major problem for the use of this kind of technology?
Yeah, and I think, again, I would largely agree, but again, it's not nearly as one-sided as that. But so, for example, when we were just chatting before we started recording, I was just mentioning there's a guy in my town. It's a very small town I live in, only 12,000 people. He's a couple of streets away. And this fellow has, in his basement, 168 computers, and those 168 computers are doing nothing except mine Bitcoin, and he hasn't turned his heating on for 2 years. And he's even offered his immediate neighbour spare heat. The immediate neighbour is the plumber, but I don't think he went for it. But so this is an argument, and particularly in the current climate, pun intended. You know, is this completely irresponsible? And arguments against Bitcoin would say it's irresponsible, that not only is it a zero-sum game where you're just investing in something intangible and waiting for it to go up or down, it's actually a negative-sum game because there are negative externalities. You are damaging the world, okay? Now, let me just give the opposite arguments to that, because there are opposite arguments. First of all, it isn't just solving mathematical puzzles. There are people now whose jobs in financial institutions depend on cryptocurrencies and bitcoins. It is an upcoming industry, number one. Number two, you have to compare it to traditional finance and banking. So, for example, if you walk through the City of London, you know, there are offices and they're all lit, and there are computers and there are computer servers that are using electricity. There are cooling systems to cool them down. So there is also energy being spent on traditional finances as well. The last thing I'd say, again, to somewhat mitigate this argument against Bitcoin, is that I believe that Bitcoin now uses worldwide, something like two-thirds renewable energy. Okay, so two-thirds of its energy is renewable sources. You could still argue, well, that energy could be used to provide jobs, etc. But 2/3 of it is green energy, and that's happened because most of the mining operation used to be in China, and it was using dirty energy, coal-fired energy. Most Bitcoin mining is now done outside of China.
Very interesting. I suppose it really depends on I guess your kind of optimism for the future of the sector. As you say, if you see Bitcoin as a, you know, it's barely 15 years old, it's a kind of nascent technological breakthrough that we're still figuring out. Every Bitcoin transacted, every Bitcoin mined could be seen as an investment in a future kind of financial model which could revolutionize the next century. And the counter argument, I suppose, is that this is ultimately a large and more technology complex version of something like, you know, tulip mania, where for years people became convinced that, you know, tulips held huge value and there were crazy auctions and prices, and then overnight the delusion broke and it crashed, and suddenly we realized that these are just flower bulbs and they're worth a few pence at most. Do you worry about the future of the sector? Do you think that the crypto winter might not just be part of an up and down, but might actually be the kind of beginning of a complete the bubble bursting?
I suppose you know, my perspective coming from the tech industry, you know, I don't know. I do believe that Bitcoin is here to stay. I believe the technologies that underpin Bitcoin are very much here to stay. And actually, there are also, which we haven't talked about yet, but there are some fairly strong ethical arguments in favour of crypto and Bitcoin as well. So I think that would be my view.
Brilliant. All right. Well, we've reached the end of this episode, unfortunately, but I'm pleased to say we'll be joining Chris again next week to take the conversation on, digging into some of the, looking at some scripture and some kind of Christian thinking around investment, finance, and trying to apply that to this brave new world of cryptocurrency. So looking forward to that. Thanks so much, Chris, for coming on, and thanks everyone for listening.
You're very
welcome.
It's
been interesting. As always, if you'd like to find out some more resources, there's plenty of stuff to read and listen to and watch at Dad's website. That's johnwyatt.com. You can follow up Chris, 7minutes.net, if I got that right.
Yes, yes, that's right, yeah.
And you can get in touch with us by emailing molad@premier.org.uk. But otherwise, we'll see you next week for part two of Cryptocurrency and Bitcoin. Hello, Tim here. Just before we go, I wanted to let you know we're planning a special episode in the next month or so to mark the 1-year anniversary of relaunching Matters of Life and Death as part of the Premier Unbelievable Network. We're going to be dedicating an episode, or maybe even two, to answering questions from you, our listeners. They can be on any topic, perhaps something you've heard us talk about over the last year that you'd like to go deeper into, or maybe instead there's a new development in the news or science that you'd be interested to hear us chat about. We can't promise to answer every question we get, but we're definitely going to try to squeeze in as many as possible into this special omnibus episode. Nothing's out of bounds, so do get in touch now by emailing molad@premier.org.uk. Thanks very much.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.